All right, this week's episode of Magnify, we're joined by a very special guest. The term brother gets thrown around a lot, but we're actually joined by my brother-in-law, my brother Vadim. What's going on, man?
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm good. So Vadim is, I always like the guests kind of introduce themselves, but I want to preface the audience, prepare the audience for the level of insight that you have. The reason I love talking to you about consumer financing and mortgages is you look at it from a very data-driven perspective, and you don't let the emotions of the narrative in the media and all that kind of stuff drive you. So I'll let you kind of give an intro to yourself, DVO1 and all that kind of stuff, and then we'll get into it.
Sounds great. Yes, brother-in-law, and happy to be here. So a little bit way of background. I am the head of research at DVO1, which is a fintech that provides market data access, intelligence, and state-of-the-art APIs, graphic interfaces, and really supports multiple facets of the structured credit markets. We started as a data hub for consumer unsecured lending about 7-8 years ago. Eight years ago now, with a mission of being able to give everybody in the industry, whether it's an issuer, a stakeholder, an investor, easy access to robust consumer-related data so that they can make informed decisions on a risk-adjusted basis, so they can understand all of the different facets that go into credit underwriting for a loan, all the different ways that those metrics also help dictate future credit risk, prepayment risk, and really creating transparency in a market that was really new at that time, really growing in from its infancy into a more kind of institutional asset class. And our founding was coming off the back of 2008, when the lack of data transparency and there was a lot of problems in 2008, but one of them certainly was the fact that a lot of investors, issuers, and most of the industry just couldn't wrap their head around how bad the mortgages have gotten. And either through laziness, through lack of data, or through both, there's a massive shakeout. The world is still in some ways recovering from that process, and hopefully DVO1 exists to not let kind of that happen again. I've been at DVO1 for just a little less than 5 years. Prior to that, I'd spent about 12 years on the buy side, trading mortgages, consumer credit, RMBS, structured credit products, all in all, and really letting data dictate the way that we made trades without really too much regard for media hysteria, let's just say, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously very, very well educated and well versed in consumer lending. Before we kind of break it down into the nitty-gritty about what's going on in the market, what's kind of your 50,000 foot view right now of where we are with consumer lending? Because everything we're hearing in the news is it's terrible, there's going to be a crash. Where do we stand?
Sure. So one of the terms I've liked to use recently and explain to people is that what we've seen over the past now 3.5 years is an extremely contracted credit cycle, which has rapid implications and robust implications for everybody involved. And what I mean by that is typically a cycle that goes end to end, especially for consumers, usually takes a long time. It could be anywhere from 6 to maybe 15 or 20 years, because people don't usually make decisions in the course of a quarter or a month. They take time. They build up savings. They make priority decisions on how they spend. They make priority decisions on how they borrow, what they spend, how much risk they're willing to take. That's a long-term process. That goes into human psychology. And what we've had since 2020, since COVID, is a fully end-to-end cycle from the perspective of institutional markets. And what we mean there is we had a full amount of massive tightening of credit standards when COVID hit. So throughout 2020, in some sectors, it took a month or two. Some sectors, it was 6 months of really tight credit underwriting, followed by an incredibly rapid loosening of credit standards. So going from 2019 as a reasonable baseline to extremely tight in 2020 and extremely loose in 2021, and all the way through to really extremely tight to modestly tight in 2022 and 2023, depending on the sector. That kind of rapid move from hot to cold is not precedent over this type of time period. It really bears repeating, this has never happened before. You haven't seen this level of gyration in lending standards at this rapid a clip. When something like this happens, again, human psychology says it takes a long time to make decisions. It means that a lot of entities, whether it's consumers, whether it's borrowers, whether it's issuers, lenders, risk takers, investors, they maybe got over their skis in 2021 or didn't take enough risk in 2020 and have to make decisions to compensate for those factors throughout 22 and 23. And this leads to kind of a perfect storm of rising rates, tightening credit standards, some borrowers having a tough time battling inflation while facing a significantly different lending environment to what they faced the previous year. When something like that happens, it does create significant moves in credit performance. Now, when you tie that, which is a rapid credit cycle, in with what we've seen, which is an equally steep rate increase, also relatively unprecedented. For context, we've moved the entirety of what we moved from 2004 through 2007 in less than half the time in terms of rate hikes. That's how quickly it went. And while we can't blame the rate increases for everything that happened in 2007 and 2008, it did have some implication. So you've got this rapid credit cycle coupled with a massively quick tightening of rates, coupled with really significantly high and very rapidly increasing inflation, means that consumers, who are unfortunately sometimes the least informed because they have the lowest ability to make decisions on the fly, you're going to have a good portion of them facing an environment that's very unusual. And what that typically causes, and what we've seen that cause here, is something I like to call a detachment from credit. Not that they don't want credit, not that they don't need credit for buying a house or buying a car, but it's people that are making very conscious decisions about what they owe and what they're going to pay. And in a lot of ways, the reason I say detachment is, since 2008, the consumer overall has been focused on improving their credit score. And what's happened over the past, say, 18 to 24 months is a portion of those people are no longer as attached to their credit score. They're attached to making sure that they can make ends meet and buy food and buy groceries and pay their rent. So they're focused on housing payments. They're focused in some cases on auto payments, certainly on food. But that would mean that some parts of the consumer credit world, whether it's unsecured, whether it's in some cases subprime auto, if it's a second car, or it's something like buy now, pay later, those are falling a little bit by the wayside.
Speak a little bit about, obviously we're going to get into mortgages and home borrowing. How does the auto industry and unsecured debt like credit cards, how is that impacting housing? And is it at all?
In truth, it's not.
Okay.
Historically, people would have thought it would have. That consumer unsecured, bad credit performance in consumer unsecured or bad performance in auto was a precursor to future default risks in the mortgage market. That's not really what we're seeing today. And again, in some cases, what people are doing is they're extrapolating past crises and applying it to today. Are they saying, right, are we getting a repeat of 2008? Are we getting a repeat of, I guess, maybe the late 80s, early 90s? And the truth is today is almost the exact opposite of that. Because of how strong the housing recovery has been, coupled with just how tight housing underwriting has been since 2008, we're seeing a situation where housing performance is really standing completely in isolation and has no real bearing to what's happening in non-housing markets. And what we mean by that is people are really focused on that housing payment. It's either, and that's actually the logical reason here is that today they have as much value in their mortgage as they have in their house. So they have record home equity, that's true. But they've also got this 3 or 4% mortgage or even 2% mortgage in a time when interest rates are 8% or inflation was 8% in 2022 and Fed funds rate is 5.25% and the 10-year is 5%. And in reality, their mortgage today, if they could sell it, would be worth significantly more than what they borrowed. So they want to hang on to this mortgage for dear life. The subprime auto, less so, and consumer unsecured, certainly much less so, because the rates don't really matter as much there. But this mortgage is a premium for them, as is their house. So we've actually had really strong homeownership growth over the past 6 years, and we've had strong mortgage growth, but in a very responsible way. And so much of that mortgage universe is sitting at very low interest rates that people just don't want to give those up. So even though we've seen a lot of anecdotes about how bad subprime auto is getting, it's important to remember that we hit record lows, I mean record all-time lows, in mortgage delinquencies twice in 2023. That's a big, big statement.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that one day at the house, and I was pretty shocked to hear that, because the narrative would certainly suggest that people are defaulting all over the place.
Don't let data ever get in the way of a story, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So talking of unsecured credit, I believe the latest number I saw was, is about $1 trillion now in terms of credit cards.
That's right.
Credit card debt, accumulated debt. Mm-hmm. Do you see a world where people are going to be, you know, you said record highs of equity in homes, where people are taking out HELOCs to pay those off at a lower interest rate?
That is absolutely something that can happen. It's, from a practical perspective, something that probably should happen for people who are thinking mm-hmm. about how to deal with their debt load. I think a lot of consumers are making these financial decisions right now for themselves. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely something that is a tailwind for home equity growth, whether it's in HELOC lending or in HEI lending, or not even lending, HEI is not a lending product, but of those two features, it's absolutely a tailwind for their growth, without question.
What kind of impact do you think that would have on housing in terms of, you know, obviously the more money you borrow against your home, the harder it becomes to sell in some ways, depending on the value of the home.
Sure, but right now, all the anecdotes that we're seeing about these markets is a trickle of the amount of equity that we've got. For context, a little, it's really possibly hard to imagine just how much home equity there is. For context, the amount of home equity that U.S. consumers have is enough to pay off 70% of the U.S. government debt. That's how big that number is. They have $21 trillion of home equity versus $1 trillion of credit card debt. So, I mean, it's massively disproportionate in size. Now, of course, people that have home equity aren't the same people that have credit card debt. It's often they're inversely correlated. But there is significant overlap in that universe. What can happen in this case is some borrowers will certainly tap the maximum amount of their equity, some, and most likely it's a fairly small portion because, again, mortgage underwriting is very tight. And especially today, people are super concerned about future home price deterioration, given how much they've risen, given the fact that they haven't really come down since rates have started rising in any material way. That's a real concern. So when you're seeing mortgage underwriters come around, they're not going to lend you 100 LTV. They're not going to let you tap all of the equity in the house. There's going to be pretty strict mm-hmm. restrictions on what you're able to access, especially because the underwriting environment, generally speaking, today is pretty tight. So on the margin, maybe small meaning it doesn't even show a material trend in aggregate data. Some borrowers will get over their skis, but it won't be enough to register in any significant amount.
So I want to get your thoughts on where you think we can go to get ourselves out of the kind of housing issues we're having right now, if you want to call them issues. But I wanted to get your opinion on this hypothesis I heard of a reverse market crash, because everyone's talking about the rates, we've got to lower the rates.
Yeah.
But with home prices continuing to, I mean, they haven't risen too much this year, but they've continued to rise a little bit, right? If they drop the rates and home prices keep continuing to rise, the gap of affordability between kind of income classes, we'll call them for lack of a better word, will actually get even larger, and you'll end up causing a bigger issue where there's only a smaller pool of buyers and people that could buy the houses in the first place. What are your thoughts on that?
When we think about the housing dynamics, it's so multifaceted and so complicated. It's hard to say. It's hard to put your finger on exactly the pulse and say, hey, this is what we need and this is what could happen. It's the question is a little bit more nuanced in the sense of dropping rates will most likely lead to continued home prices, home price increase. And it should take some borrowers out of the market for sure, but it's tricky to figure out who those borrowers are. Because one thing that we have to remember is maybe got missed in everything that's been going on, but home ownership rates have been steadily increasing over several years now. They hit maybe a multi-sector or multi-decade low in 2013, 2014 after the GFC, and they've actually risen so rapidly that on what I call an adjusted basis, they're pretty close to record highs. And I mean, and that meaning all-time record highs. And this is considering all the things that we hear about millennials not owning and Gen Z not owning and nobody can afford housing. Well, truth is we're at almost 66% home ownership rate. The only time we've ever been higher is from 2000 to 2006. And at least three or four of those years, if not all of them, should be significant caveated because a lot of lending happened in those times that should not have happened. We don't know how many borrowers bought homes that maybe weren't qualified for, or maybe they took too much credit, or maybe they were logically given a put option. They were given a 100 LTV loan and they said either pay it, or if your house goes down in price and you don't care about your credit score, walk away. And millions of people did that. So on that adjusted basis, we're at 66%. That's pretty close to highs. The record high, by the way, is 69. That's in 2005. And the historical range is around 62, 63. And another thing to keep in mind is much of that growth has been at the lower income, not the higher income. Higher income home ownership has actually been falling for the past couple of years, offset by increases at the lower end. And at that lower end, we're at all-time records, period. Significantly higher than we were in 2000, significantly higher than we were pretty much at any point. So if home prices were to keep going up because rates were going down, it's pretty clear there's a large demand for housing. I think the demand for housing hasn't gone away. And we continue to see a lot of surveys, whether it's the FHFA, Fannie, Freddie, a bunch of entities, there's clearly a desire for people to own homes. The fundamental problem is the supply. We have underbuilt homes in America by in the magnitude of millions. It's not a question of whether we're short. It's a question of how many million are we short. And unfortunately, we had 15 years where low rates didn't change that equation because investors, builders, and everybody was very reticent. When I said that credit cycles are long, they're long. There's a lot of entities that are still thinking that 2008 was last week, and they're making decisions accordingly. They're not buying too much land or building too many homes or going off in speculative universe and just build nonstop. There's also a huge amount of pressure in home building from the lack of availability of developed land to issues of permitting and how expensive that's gotten, to materials, to labor, to the lack of good land, to even things like transportation infrastructure. It's not easy to just ramp up supply, so we haven't really had it. If rates were to go down, it's likely that home prices will keep rising, but it's not necessarily likely that it'll deter a lot of borrowers. More than likely, affordability ratios will go down and borrowers will stretch to buy. So right. The fundamental question, and I know I'm getting a little long-winded here, is a question of affordability. But when you think about affordability, it's the only context where you really think that it's bad is if you do it in relation to historical affordability ratios in the United States. If you were to take the U.S. and compare it to most other nations of equal development index, the U.S. has surprisingly low cost of homeownership. Like, surprisingly low. If you think it's bad here, look at Canada, Australia, any of the Scandinavian countries, or the Netherlands, or the UK, or most of France. In fact, most countries that you would comp to the US on a kind of economic strength basis, the US has much cheaper housing. So from that perspective, it's hard to say.
So that's a very interesting look at the market, because it kind of does fly in the face of what this narrative is, that you know, once the rates come down, people will start wanting to sell. You know, 9 out of 10 homeowners right now are locked in under 6%, right?
That's right. And I'll give you even better one than that.
Yeah.
8 out of 10 or something like 80% of loans are locked in at 4 or below. So it's not a question of going down 100 basis points for them. They're not refinancing unless rates go down 300 basis points. So it's a big, big universe. And a lot of that remaining 20%, by the way, are very old loans. I think something like 30 or 40% of the loans that are above 4 are originated before 2010.
Yeah. And so it kind of does sound like supply is the issue, right? It's the very, very basic economics, right? Supply and demand.
Absolutely.
We have a lot of demand, so the prices are high and not much supply.
That's right.
So, you know, because if you think about it, people may be willing to forego their rates, get into a higher rate for a more affordable payment or a smaller house, right? It's just the fact that they don't have that option right now because this is perfect storm of high rates and low supplies.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. Where do you see, just on the rate side of things, where do you see things going in the next 12 to 18 months? And do you expect election year to have any kind of play on that? Do you think they're going to keep things where they are, or you know, where do we think that's going to go?
It really depends. And unfortunately, the idea of rate paths is fairly complicated, and almost no one's been exactly right on it. And we're not really great interest rate forecasters here, so we don't have any great insights that other people won't have. The truth is, rates will materially change once we see inflation fully at the Fed's mandate, what they consider their mandate. That's not the definition that's typically used in the media of, hey, this is what CPI is or this is what PCE is. This is based on the Fed's reading, and the Fed has pretty much indicated that inflation has come down quite substantially. We don't know if that means they're at peaking, and more importantly, it's most likely true that the Fed will not raise rates much from here, if at all, but there's no indicator, there's no definitive need for them to cut rates either. Truthfully, it's very hard to see what will bring consumption patterns back to 2019 levels. In some cases, we don't really know what it might be. There's a huge amount of variables that have gone into this. Not the least of which, by the way, we talked about the rapid contraction in credits or rapid credit cycle. We've talked about the detachment from credit. The Wall Street Journal, to their credit, actually, and quite a few publications have picked this up, have picked up on the narrative that there's a lot of excess spending that is right now being done by older households, not younger ones. In some ways, because maybe they have got an increased fear of mortality after COVID took so many of their lives. So you've seen rapid and almost sustained spending among older generation households. And that's a lot of pent-up spending. A lot. Because that is the generation that has a humongous amount of worth. The net worth, I think, for last I checked, for people 65 or over is something close to $76 trillion. So 3 times the size of the U.S. debt burden. So that amount of spending, that's pretty big. That's a pretty strong headwind from falling inflation. Will it all be spent? Of course not. Of course it won't. But if they continue to spend because they think life is short and this is a good time to spend, so then even regardless of what's happening with other households, it may continue to pressure inflation, which will continue to mandate that rates stay high.
Okay. So, you know, obviously this is a podcast geared towards real estate agents.
Yeah.
Based on the data you're seeing, where do you think potential business opportunities lie for agents? Who are the most likely to kind of break this cycle and start buying or selling?
So this is actually an interesting area and something I've been exploring recently. We, about 3 months ago, released a paper where we've, at DV01, we've created a housing affordability metric across counties. So every county, major county in the U.S., so north of 3,000 counties, we have relative affordability ratios for. At point in time, through now third quarter 23, going all the way back to the 2000s. And we've gotten a lot of great reviews about this data set. And recently, we've taken another hard look at it and updated it for what we think are significant changes in the insurance component of the mortgage payment. It's a small component. A lot of people don't think about insurance in the mortgage payment, but in certain areas, it's become a humongous thing. And I think the epicenter of that is Florida. Florida is a huge market by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly one of the biggest states in America by population. I think it's 3 or 4 in count, if I'm not mistaken. It's a big housing market. It's been a source of a lot of development. And it's seen rapid, ostentatious growth in insurance costs over the past 3 years. Three years is a short timeline. Really 5 to 10 years, but it's been really accelerating over the past 3 years. Something to the degree of Florida, I think, now be having insurance costs tripled in the past 3 years. And the funny thing about insurance is this is the only metric that in some ways impacts existing homeowners more than it does new homeowners. Because the existing buyer base knows what the cost is, and it's going up on them all the time. Property taxes go up, but not really all that much. They go up, you know, maybe a few percent a year at most, usually 2 or 1 or some nominal number like that. But seeing your insurance costs triple over the past 3 years, that's a big, big, big burden. That is something that could create selling pressure, very legitimate, very real selling pressure, because it's been so rapid. For context, before we looked at insurance, we had Florida's slightly above average in terms of bad affordability. I think it was number 17 out of 50 states in terms of affordability by ranking. When you add in insurance on a relative basis, it jumps to number 3 on least affordable. Sorry, number 4, just behind California, New York, and Montana for very kitschy reason, not really anything to do with Montana. So that could create potentially a lot of selling pressure. And that's a state that's normally known for high housing activity. So that's a possibility. There are other states that are facing similar insurance pressures. Texas, certainly, Louisiana, certainly, are big ones that come to mind. And other states in Tornado Alley, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, similar. And they also have their own specific state level insurance problems. But it's just not as rapid in recent years. And it isn't as drastic as it is in Florida. So that's an area where you could see a lot of this kind of activity. It could certainly create different migration patterns. You could see a lot of entities, or you can see movement out of Miami-Dade or Broward or counties that are particularly hard hit from an insurance perspective. That's a potential source of activity, and certainly what we have to look at is a new housing market. There is a lot of build going on. It's not a lot by historical standards. It's certainly a tiny fraction if you compare to anything pre-2008. And I'm talking not in the years up leading up to it. I'm talking even the 70s, the 80s, parts of the 90s. So you can see more activity there. And there is a very, very long tail economic trend of boomers eventually selling their homes. That eventually is going to take a long time. But this is a big generation. This is an older generation. And certainly over time, each year, a certain percentage of them will pass away. So that will create long-term supply. But long-term is a really long time. In terms of near-term, I mean, the inventory numbers speak for themselves. We've been hovering around record low inventory pace for the better part of 2 years now. And the when we say record, the previous record to that was the year prior, and then the year prior. We've been setting new inventory record lows really for 6 or 7 years now, and it continues to drift lower. So there's unfortunately no magic bullet of supply when it comes to amount of properties available. There doesn't seem to be something that's going to drive that other than exogenous factors, and the chief among them is climate change and the insurance impact of that.
Yeah. So that's interesting then. So even when we had this big, you know, big quote unquote boom 2021, that was still with record low inventory?
Yeah. Because keep in mind the boom that we saw, it wasn't really, it was a boom in sales, but it's an annualized boom in sales. It's a big spike in 1 year. It's not sustained. Right. And it was because of the fact that 2020 was also pretty depressed. And 2019 was kind of an average year. But it wasn't this earth-shattering boom. It didn't sustain long enough. And oh, by the way, all the supply that was bought up in 2021 has been taken off the market. It's not that those borrowers, the people who bought, are now coming to market to sell.
Yeah.
And we also had a once-in-a-lifetime situation. And we really mean lifetime, because you had a year of people being cooped up in homes, living with their parents. And on the back of that, you had very strong economic recovery. You had several stimulus check payments. You had pauses in evictions and rent moratorium. You had student loan forbearance plans. So you had people with a lot of excess capital, and one of the first things they wanted to buy was a house. It's kind of not a replicable year by any stretch of the imagination. 2021 will be one of those absolutely unique years that probably won't be replicated in our professional lifetimes.
Yeah, so I think cautionary tale there for agents is don't expect to see that kind of pace again. A lot of people got in during that time, and I think it's with false expectations of how the market really, really is on a regular basis.
I would say that's right. And the idea of what a regular market is will continue to be redefined. Yeah. Housing has not had a regular market in, I would argue, close to 20 years.
Well, yeah.
Maybe more
it's
than
been
that.
Nearly, it's been 15, 16 years since the recession, right?
But then prior to that, 05, 06, 07, when a lot of people entered the market too, wasn't by any stretch of the imagination normal, nor was 03, 04. You have to go back to maybe 2000, 2001, 99 to see what a normal housing market looks like. And a lot of people just haven't been in the industry that long.
Right. Yeah. So really the key is to be flexible, adaptable, and just stay on top of the trends and the data. To that point, where can people find more information from you if they want to get in touch with you? I definitely want to put a link to people to be able to sign up for the newsletter you guys send out. I just got one this morning.
Absolutely. Yeah. So our site is DV01, DV01, like my shirt, .co. Yeah. And there's a research section on there. Research will always be free. It's a simple sign-on, no paywalls, no nothing. We publish about 6 pieces of research every month, 4 to 6. Some of it is fairly tailored to specific markets, but a lot of it has relevance to housing, to the mortgage market writ large, and we provide a mix of credit commentary and broad housing market insights, as well as any insights on general consumer trends that we found.
Awesome. I'll make sure to link that. And you guys have a podcast too. What's the name of that?
It's called In the Tranches of Structured Finance podcast. And I'm its host.
Awesome. So go and check that out too. I'll link that in the notes too. Well, bro, it was great. Thank you. I got out of you what I wanted. I feel like agents are going to have a better understanding of the market.
I feel so terribly used.
No, all right, man. Appreciate it. Thank you.
The one thing I'll leave, I know this is a podcast for real estate agents. And I think for you guys who have been in the market for a little while, you've seen this kind of seesaw and it seems to be scary. I would say for a bit of cautionary tale, unfortunately, real estate is almost always a seesaw. It never looks normal in the moment. In the moment, everything always seems crazy. In the moment, 2008 or 2007 seemed crazy, as did 2008, as did 2009, for very, very different reasons. What I found is the people that stay and the people that continue to succeed in an industry are able to buttress the tough times and able to recalibrate strategy, find new opportunities, and find a way to get themselves protected in a downside. For people that see a downside for the first time, it's the scariest thing, because it may feel like all of a sudden the rug's been pulled out from under you and everything is falling apart. And how did this happen in my industry when everything has seemed so normal? That is far more common than you think in real estate. It's far more common than you would imagine. And there are lots of factors moving for and against real estate. Being able to ride those factors out is kind of key to survival.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And like I said, I think having this kind of data that you guys are providing for free will only kind of help strengthen your position in the market. So Absolutely. Big shout out for you guys doing that. We'll wrap it up. That was great. I appreciate it, man.
Of course, my friend. Talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye.